Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. There's no doubt that the Internet has radically changed our world and the way that we live in it. It's been touted as the great social equalizer. It was supposed to provide a level playing field where everyone can participate and anyone can thrive.
But our next guest says we need to take a more critical look at who really benefits from our new digital culture. Astra Taylor is a Canadian-American documentary filmmaker, writer, and musician. Her new book is The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Astra, thanks for joining us on Central Time.
Oh, thanks for joining. Thanks for having me.
Well, in the early days of the Internet, there were some early adopters who had almost a utopian viewpoint. It was going to be a liberating force, democratizing. It was going to give us a lot of access and unleash a big creative force. You say it hasn't panned out that way, though. How has that changed? How has it really gone since the beginning of the Internet?
Well, the story is more complicated, and all of us who use the Internet every day, as most of us do, we know that. You know, we see that it's a space where you can have democratic participation, and you can also do your shopping, and you can also troll people or whatever. We know it's complicated, but there was this intense utopianism around it, but at the same time, there were also commenters who were convinced that everything was going to change for the worse, for everybody who said the Internet would make us more connected, there was somebody who said it would make us more distracted. For everyone who said it would make us more intelligent and smart, there's someone who said it's, you know, destroying our ability to read. So the truth is somewhere in between. And I think what we haven't been paying enough attention to in the popular debate is the social and economic context that these technologies develop in. We really haven't been paying enough attention to the economic question, because so much of what shaped our old media landscape, the old media landscape that was supposed to be overthrown and revolutionized, were business incentives. So we had television that catered to advertisers, and that shaped the whole system. And social media platforms and all of these services we use every day are also beholden to advertisers. So that's one industry that hasn't been disrupted. If anything, it's spread and is more ubiquitous and omnipresent than it was under the old model. So, you know, the business imperatives are similar, and thus the technology is shaped in ways that make the new order look a lot like the old.
Well, one of the hopes was that, hey, this Internet is going to clear away a lot of the old gatekeepers for creative people, for people who do independent journalism, who are people who are doing music, making documentaries. We'll get those gatekeepers out of the way and be able to reach the public directly. How has that played out?
Well, the gatekeepers are still there. They've just shape-shifted a bit. I mean, what's interesting is, first off, all the old media dinosaurs, as they were often called by technology pundits, they haven't gone extinct. They've actually adapted quite well. And so legacy media organizations are making record profits. But what we have alongside of the old like Hollywood tycoons, if you will, are these new Silicon Valley moguls. So we've got sort of the new and the old coexisting and sometimes collaborating and making deals with each other. So, you know, the old guard is still there. People are still watching TV. In fact, statistics show we're watching more television than ever. But then we're also using our Facebook, and we're searching for things on Google. And those mediators are really powerful. Google search algorithms can make or break a publication. It has immense power because it's essentially an information monopoly. It's the search engine everybody knows and everybody uses. We don't even say we're searching something, right? We say we're Googling it. But of course, Google isn't, you know, a neutral forum to find information through. It has to rank things and it has to make a profit. And so it privileges some information over others. And the values that are woven into its code are not neutral. And those are the things we have to be like more critical and aware of. And I think they're really crucial for media literacy for the generation that's coming up.
How has all of this affected the creatives, musicians like you, people writing? We see a lot of people putting a lot of music and a lot of fiction and a lot of other creative output onto the Internet. Isn't that a good thing?
Definitely. It's definitely a good thing. And I think that we can celebrate people communicating and sharing and creating. But the credit goes to the human beings who are creating things and not necessarily the companies that they're interfacing with. I mean, if I had a meaningful conversation with you over the telephone 20 years ago, we'd give credit to ourselves and not the telephone. So I think the humans deserve the credit. But there are ways in which the barriers or the obstacles that people face are a little less visible than they used to be. It used to be really obvious. You could look at the masthead of a magazine and go, okay, those are the editors. Those are the gatekeepers. Now it's not so clear. But increasingly, you know, the most popular video makers on YouTube, people who have sometimes millions of subscribers to their YouTube channel, are actually being managed by talent companies, working closely with advertisers and creating sponsored content. In some cases, those talent companies and production companies are actually owned by traditional Hollywood media companies. It's just not on the surface. It's hidden. It's kind of invisibilized, if you will. And so what happens is money and connections and celebrity and being sensational are just as crucial to this new order as they were. But there's this myth that it's a meritocracy and that the best will just rise to the surface. So I think we need to ask ourselves why, if that's the case, you know, are the same old superstars still superstars, and challenge this idea that we have a level playing field.
Well, one of the solutions you suggest, being in public broadcasting, was interesting. You're proposing, if I'm reading it right, something like a public internet media entity. What would that look like?
Yeah, there's this idea that because we don't have spectrum scarcity, that we don't need public media. So spectrum scarcity is the idea that, you know, when you had a television, there was a limited spectrum, so there were limited channels, and we had a sort of imperative to carve off a few of those and create a space for educational or alternative non-commercial programming. But of course, that wasn't just given over to people without a fight. It was something that we to organize for and advocate for and make arguments for. And sort of what happened was the advertising supported television and the soap operas that sold soap and the quiz shows that were rigged just got too much. It was too much to bear. People wanted a line between editorial content and advertising, and they fought. The idea now is that there's infinite, you know, hypothetically infinite space on the internet, so we don't need an option like that. And I disagree. I think that we're actually in a kind of similar situation where there's more and more sponsored content. It's unclear whether the people speaking are actually being paid, whose interests they're serving. And we talk about things like Facebook and Twitter like their town squares, like their public spaces, when in fact they're more like shopping malls because they are driven by advertising and which is about selling us stuff. And I think we actually should put our heads together and think of a public option. And that doesn't mean that it's the only business model that should exist, but I think it would be good to supplement what's out there with something else. And we've had a similar change of course in the past. I'm talking about a space that is has a different business model that wouldn't ultimately be in the business of surveillance, which is what advertising online is, because online the ads and marketers track you. It's not like the old days where you just watched the ad and turned it off. And thinking about funding things through some sort of subsidy or tax revenue. And, you know, this happens in lots of realms of life. So it's not so far-fetched.
People have said, well, why a top-down thing when you've got bottom-up collaborations, something like Wikipedia? Why don't we see more things along that kind of model?
That's a really good question. Why don't we see more things along that kind of model? Because it's held up as the paragon of a new participatory democratic digital model. And there are many, many books and articles that hail Wikipedia as sort of what we should be, how we should actually imagine the new digital world. And actually what's striking is that there's only one Wikipedia. There, of all of the top sites we use, and this is backed up by ComScore data, you know, it's the only non-commercial site that's in the top 50. You know, otherwise we go to commercial sites. So it's very rare. And in that sense, it's precious. And part of that is that, you know, it is very difficult to fund a site like Wikipedia. They often have to, you know, struggle through their funding drives. and scramble for support. And we don't have sort of social mechanisms to create more spaces like that. So I think, you know, Wikipedia gets a lot of attention, but I think we should recognize how unique it is.
You titled your book, The People's Platform. What are you hoping people do, individual internet users, to change things?
Well, I think the first step is understanding and analyzing things. I think right now we're at a really interesting moment where there's a kind of inchoate sense that things have gone awry, and a lot of that has to do with the NSA revelations, and you know, there's a sense that we're all addicted to our phones, and it's not making us feel good, or this or that. And I kind of want people to step back and look at those emotions and look at those feelings of skepticism and take it to the next level and ask why it is that all of the good things we were promised and that we hope for haven't come to pass. And I think it has to do with the fact that the internet is born of the real world, and it can't escape some of the structural conditions, the fact that, you know, the rich get richer, and that, you know, you have to adhere to the bottom line. And so you have to look at it in that context, in the actual real world. And then you can think about realistic ways of making it better. So I think people have to think critically and then start organizing and aggregating their voices to demand something else.
Astra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
That was Astra Taylor, Canadian-American documentary filmmaker. Her new book is The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age.
For zeroing in on a case before the Supreme Court surrounding a law in Ohio that makes it illegal to make false statements in campaign ads during an election, justices heard arguments in the case yesterday, which is raising doubts about laws barring campaign lies in more than 15 states.
Donald Downs is with us now to discuss the case and its possible implications. He's a professor of political science, law, journalism, and mass communication at UW-Madison. Donald, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
So a law outlawing lies, in this case directed at political candidates, saying you can't specifically tell a lie about a candidate in an election. How common is this?
Well, how common is it for politicians to lie or for such laws to exist? Well, actually, I looked up yesterday. At least 20 states have such laws on the books. They're not often enforced for obvious reasons, but at least they're out there on the books. So I guess the answer is not enforced a lot, but they're out there.
Now, I'm a fairly simple guy. I would assume that when a law like this goes before the Supreme Court, they're going to rule on whether it's constitutional. That's not exactly – it's right. Kind of angling in sideways to the court.
Yeah, because they have a doctrine called standing that in order to bring a case before a federal court, you have to have what is called under the Constitution an actual case in controversy, which means that a law or government action had to have directly harmed you, okay, among other things. And in this case, the case was dropped in Ohio because the company that wanted to put up the so-called offending billboard decided not to do it. So the issue is whether the groups that have brought the Susan B. Anthony group has an actual harm or case in controversy that it can bring to the court. So that's called a standing issue. And that's the real issue before the court. But somewhat unusually, the justices actually talked a lot about the substance and merits of the law, too, which indicated they don't like the law.
Is that a sign that even though this isn't a direct constitutional challenge to this kind of law, they might expand their ruling to tackle that issue?
Yeah. Well, it is a constitutional challenge, but the question is whether the court should deal with the standing issue or the substantive issue. But, yeah, I think it's a definite sign. And, you know, it's conceivable the court would grant standing and then even go on and make a decision based on the merits, but that's probably not going to happen. But it would clearly send a signal that if this gets back to the court in a proper way, they're going to rule against it. And if they do make this ruling, there's going to be, you know, signals out there to all sorts of parties to bring lawsuits. So it'll get back to the court mighty quick.
Well, let's look at this concept of a state law saying you can't make a false statement about a candidate in an election. This is a weird First Amendment issue. You spend a lot of your time thinking about the First Amendment. What do you make of this idea?
Well, different levels we can talk about it, but I think it's a really bad law for a lot of reasons. I mean, one is you have to prove intent to lie. I mean, politicians all the time don't carry out their promises for obvious reasons. There have been philosophical essays written about the tension between truth and politics. that's not to justify politics lying so many times, politicians lying, but it just is, it happens in life. And you look at the facts in this case, it could very well be that the Susan B. Anthony group, they thought they were speaking the truth. And so if they can end up, they can go to prison, I think, for up to 6 months in this case. That would really be a chilling effect on people criticizing politicians, which goes to the heart of the First Amendment.
Well, that's when we see these PolitiFact stories in the papers.
Right.
You always see challenges to people that they rule pants on fire. We start interpreting, and there's nuance and things like that. Who's the judge of what's true in a case like this?
Well, the First Amendment requires that we, the people, be the judge. Let the marketplace of ideas decide that. You know, there's a similar case 2 years ago, the Alvarez case involving the Stolen Valor Act, where a man was prosecuted and convicted for claiming that he had won a Medal of Honor or something like that in Vietnam. And that was proved to be a lie. So Congress passed a law against it. And so you're going to criminalize someone now for sort of exaggerating their past in order to impress someone at a bar. And the court threw that out. You know, it was an 8-1 decision. It should have been 9-0. And I think if that's so, you're going after people for saying false things about politicians, even if there's not an intent to lie, would be really problematic.
Okay, but what if I say candidate Smith has been convicted of bank robbery,
right,
and candidate Smith has never done such a thing?
Right.
Should there be a law against that, or is it covered by libel laws?
It's
I don't know.
Covered by libel law. But because he's running for office, he's a public figure, and if he wins, or she wins, he's a public official. There's a higher constitutional standard of proof. It's called the actual malice test. You might have seen this in the movie Absence of Malice and other TV shows, where you have to show that the person either knew it was a lie or that they recklessly disregarded the truth. It's a pretty high standard. It's very difficult to meet. But yes, and apparently the politician in this case did do a libel suit, and he lost. So yeah, we have laws on the books against libel. Just because you're running for office doesn't mean that you can't bring a libel suit, but it's a pretty high standard of proof. And the law in Ohio allowed the lawsuit to proceed at a much lower level of proof.
So if I step forward and run for office, people can say pretty much any darn thing about me.
Unfortunately. But, you know, that's a byproduct of protecting the incentive to engage in honest debate. Because people will be wrong. And, you know, we had a president of the United States who said, "I didn't have sex with that woman." We had a president who, before Clinton, who said, "I am not a crook." You know, we don't send them to prison just for that.
Have courts historically been pretty reluctant to do anything like this, or to rule in favor of anything like this, that they would worry that chills political speech?
Absolutely. Especially since 1964, a famous New York Times case where they came up with that actual malice standard for public officials. There's another case where, back in 1982, where it was another kind of law that, I don't recall exactly what its content was, but the court struck it down, too. It was another one of these truth in politics kinds of laws. 1974, the Supreme Court said, under the First Amendment, there's no such thing as a false idea, because we proffer ideas and thoughts all the time that end up being false. Now, being false is different from lying, right? There is a kind of a difference there. But in the real world, you want to make sure you protect as much speech as possible, because that line is really hard to distinguish.
So the old, anything short of yelling fire in a crowded theater is protected speech.
Yeah, with one qualification, shouting fire falsely in a crowded theater. Everybody misses that, even the Supreme Court.
Oh, right, that's true. If there really is a fire.
Yeah, if there is a fire, I guess you should yell it, but you got to be kind of careful, because you could still get a stampede.
Well, another almost platitude is the solution to speech like this is more speech. Do you think that our media culture, the way we cover politics, does enough to flush out the false statements?
Well, I think so. But, you know, given all the noise out there, I don't want to be Pollyannish about that. It's often really hard to counter these kinds of things. So, you know, it's really a question of weighing the downsides, and having a sort of a truth squad out there in a commission who made a partisan decision, because it was two Democrats voted in favor of the politician and the one Republican didn't. You know, do you want a truth squad like that? Is that a bigger downside than having to put up with this stuff and rely on the marketplace of ideas to respond? I would say that, you know, the biggest downside is having the truth squad out there, the truth commission.
We're talking about a case being considered now by the Supreme Court, oral arguments this week. It centers on an Ohio law that makes lying in political ads, specifically making false statements about a political candidate, illegal. Our guest is Donald Downs. He's a professor of political science, law, and journalism, and mass communication at UW-Madison.
We're continuing our conversation with Donald Downs, professor of political science at UW-Madison, talking about a Supreme Court case considering an Ohio law that makes it illegal to lie about political candidates in campaign ads.
Well, what do you think? Do you think this kind of law is a good idea? Should it be illegal to put up a campaign ad that makes a false statement about a candidate? Good idea, bad idea? If you like it, how would you like to see it enforced? If not, what's your argument against it? And if not a law, what should happen to deal with lies in political campaigns? Do you think the media needs to step up more? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Get on the line now or email talk@wpr.org. Donald, before we get to the calls, you mentioned that courts typically are suspicious of this kind of law, and yet they're on the books, and I think you said, or something like this is on the books in about 20 states. Why haven't we seen more conflict on that?
Yeah, well, because there hasn't been all that much enforcement up until now in this case. And I guess, you know, that's the main reason. There just hasn't been that much enforcement. And also because the Supreme Court really hasn't directly dealt with this issue until a couple years ago in that stolen valor case, at least in recent times. So there hasn't been that much law out there on the constitutional side, and there hasn't been that much enforcement until now.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got John on the line in Milwaukee. John, hi, you're on the air.
I wonder, how curious is it that they don't want you to lie on politicians, and yet you let politicians lie all the time? Don't lying is the only thing they do more than steal.
All right, so if the politicians can lie, we can lie about the politicians, I guess, is the logical connection there.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. The First Amendment is premised on the idea that when it comes to determining truth, it's in the hands of we the people, not a truth squad. And I think the caller is sort of speaking to that. Politicians have enough special privileges as it is.
Do we, the voters in this case, do enough to take on politicians and hold them accountable, do you think, in elections, given all the incumbents that get reelected?
I think that's a really good point, especially when it comes to congressional districts that are gerrymandered. You know, it's hard to vote these guys out. I think in the end, people vote for the politicians that they like, regardless of these issues, and also if those politicians represent their interests. So I think truth in politics is probably not one of the main things that voters bring to the polling booth, unfortunately.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Bill in Waupaca with us. Bill, hi.
Good afternoon. I've been waiting for this subject to come up for a long, long time, and I'm certainly glad to hear it on air. I guess my comments are that it should be carried a lot further than what we're talking about at this point. And, you know, I'd like to see that carried right through state and federal legislatures, including our illustrious attorney general. And I really think that there should be like a point system that's applied like in a sliding scale. And when you reach to a certain amount, depending on how bad your lies really are, that you should be maybe removed from office. I just think this is gone way out of line. People lie, I won't go into names, but it's just terrible, and there's no accountability. And I guess I'll leave it at that, but it's really a situation that's way out of hand and uncontrolled.
Bill, thanks for the call. That seems like it might be a tall order, too, Don. A law requiring politicians to tell the truth and giving them, a driver's license, points for lying.
Well, I mean, the big question in law often is who's going to make this decision? Mm-hmm. And despite all the complicated constitutional doctrine and all that stuff that constitutes constitutional law, in the First Amendment, the two most important words are who decides. And I want to know who's going to be put on this commission. Is it going to be biased in terms of its, you know, partisanship and all that? So we say we don't trust the politicians to tell the truth. Well, why should we trust some politically appointed board to tell us what is truth and therefore even apply that to politicians? So I don't see how that can possibly be a remedy. Though I certainly understand the caller's lament.
Here in Wisconsin, over the last few years, a lot of people have pointed to our recall system as a way of sort of accomplishing what he's looking at there.
Right. Yeah. And, of course, historically, that was hardly ever used. Mm-hmm. But it's mainly used for, you know, something like high crimes and misdemeanors. But that would be, you know, one way you could do that if you wanted to activate that. Certainly better than truth squads.
Bill, thanks for the call. We've got Mark on the line now in Appleton. Mark, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I mean, it seems to me that this is really important, especially given the recent Citizens United and other kinds of Supreme Court decisions that are flooding with money. I mean, it just seems to me that putting out false ads is the same as slander or libel, and that's not covered under the First Amendment.
Correct.
And it seems to me neither should false ads. And that's, maybe if you have to go to court, then not a commission, but going to court to contest them. But it seems to me that this should be illegal. And
Don?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we already have the books, law in the books about libel and slander. Why not just apply those? And don't forget, if you're doing this, if you set up a commission like this, you are giving more power to the very politicians that are either running for office or are in office. And it takes power away from we the people. Now, one of the big concerns about Citizens United is that it gives more power to the moneyed interest and not enough to the rest of us. Well, something like this would stack the deck even more, perhaps.
All right. Thanks for the call. We've got Michael in Milwaukee County now. Michael, hi.
I'm sort of on the deal with Mark, and I don't think that I agree with you. That I wouldn't go against a politician for lying, but these third-party groups that get to be anonymous, that have unlimited money, I think that in some way we have to have a mechanism for disciplining them.
All right. Thanks for the call, Michael. And both of those callers worried not just about the lying, but also the impact, I think, of Citizens United, the growth of third-party groups, and the idea of paying for a political ad as a kind of free speech.
Yeah. But we can't forget, you know, a lot of this stuff is a matter of opinion. And you take a complicated case like the claim in the Ohio case that the Obamacare Act would involve taxpayer funding of abortions. Well, from one technical perspective, it doesn't, right? Because that's not supposedly a tax. But then again, the Supreme Court ruled that the mandate to pay into Obamacare was a tax, and taxpayers are going to be paying for a lot of Obamacare. So who's right, that it's a tax or it isn't? A lot of these are judgment calls, and we're now going to criminalize disagreements on these issues through a process like this. I find that really detrimental to free speech.
Michael, thanks for the call. Diane joins us now from Duluth. Diane, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to know why the laws of libel don't apply.
Well, they do apply. If you said, for example, candidate X, we know that candidate X has committed adultery against his wife, and candidate X can prove that that was not true, then you have a libel suit. And the fact that he's a candidate doesn't immunize the people that he's suing. It's just that because he's a candidate, the level of proof is pretty high because we're engaging in political speech. But libel laws do apply.
But the bar is higher than, say, for an ordinary citizen.
That is correct. Considerably higher. But there's a, you know, look back at the history of free speech in this country. When the Supreme Court ruled that when it comes to suing public officials or figures for libel, the bar should be high because otherwise there's going to be all sorts of lawsuits against people who say things that you just don't like. And you can ruin someone financially even if you end up losing your case against them because they have to pay for a lawyer to defend themselves. So there goes political speech.
All right, we've got Karen in Franklin with us now. Karen, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering why we couldn't have something more like a narcissism law saying that rather than bashing your opponent, the only thing you can do is talk about yourself and how great you are and what you can do for people.
Don, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a great it's humorous. It certainly doesn't avoid all the other problems that we've been talking about. But, you know, maybe people should at least talk about how that's how we should evaluate candidates.
You know, in conclusion, it seems like no matter what we do, if we want to have some latitude for political free speech, mm-hmm. As much as we like electoral politics, it's going to be dirty and messy no matter what we do.
Yeah. And you know what? It always has been. You know, don't listen to people that say politics is dirtier today than it used to be. Read any book on the history of political campaigning and politicians going after one another. It's nothing new under the sun. We just have more of it now because of the media.
We'll leave it there. Don, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Sure, my pleasure.
That was Donald Downs. He's professor of political science, law, journalism, and mass communication at UW-Madison. This week marks the 450th birthday of William Shakespeare, and while the details of his birth are a bit hazy, there's a good chance that today is the actual day.
Our next guest brings Shakespeare to life in Wisconsin as an actor and a director, and by portraying Shakespeare himself in events around the state.
Ron Scott Fry is in our Milwaukee studio. He's artistic director for the Optimist Theater in Milwaukee. He's barnstorming Wisconsin in live events called To Be, Shakespeare Here and Now, including, by the way, tomorrow in Chippewa Falls. We've got a link to an event calendar from the Wisconsin Humanities Council on the Central Time Facebook page. You can find out where he's coming next. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you're a missionary for all things Shakespeare. Why do you want 21st century Wisconsin to stay in touch with the Bard?
Because I want everyone's lives to be richer and everyone's lives to contain more fascination. And I love to see the look on people's faces when they confront things that are really challenging for them and are successful. Shakespeare is a perfect opportunity for people to do something that will enrich their lives, that requires something from them, but that makes them extraordinarily successful once they get it.
And you're an emissary for Shakespeare by becoming Shakespeare himself in performances. And it seems like we don't know a whole lot about Shakespeare. The details are a little bit hazy. Even his birthday is hard to pin down with exact certainty. So how do you get in character? How do you become William Shakespeare?
I try to have as good an understanding as I can of those few facts that exist. There aren't a lot of things that are known specifically about Shakespeare, but there are a lot of things that are known about the times that he lived in. There are a lot of things that people know about theater production from the time, and there are a lot of things that people know about his plays. And so a lot of the information I share may not be specific to Shakespeare the person, but has a lot to do with the times he lived in, the theater that he created, and his body of work. And once you add those things, it's the Herculean task of trying to narrow things down.
And when you're out there being Shakespeare, whether you're here in Wisconsin or I know you've been as far away as Italy to do this, what questions do people want to ask about or even of William Shakespeare?
A lot of people want to know what my favorite play is, which is a difficult question to answer because we have actually no historical record of what Shakespeare's favorite play was. But a lot of people will also ask about some of my pronunciations and some of the phrases that I use. For instance, I'll refer to the audience as gentle cousins. And frequently people will ask why I call them gentle cousins, and I'll explain that it's not the use of either of those words that they're familiar with. Gentle is like the gentle in gentleman. It is a sign of status. And cousin is a phrase that people in the Renaissance would use to call their friends. They would be cousin or cuz. So it gives me a fun chance to explain why I call them gentle cousins.
Now, I know you perform across Wisconsin, so we've asked you to give us a little taste of what it is that you bring when you become Shakespeare. Can you give us a little performance?
I absolutely will. I would love to. I want to do for you one of my favorite sonnets, and it's one of my favorites because it seems at the beginning almost like an anti-sonnet, almost like it is anti-romantic, but at the end it becomes very, very beautiful. My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun. If hairs be wires, black wires grow on her head. Now I have seen roses, damasked, red and white, but no such roses see I in her cheeks. And in some perfumes there is more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks. I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music hath a far more pleasing sound. I grant I never saw a goddess go. My mistress, when she goes, treads on the ground. And yet, by heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belied by false compare.
Wow, he really does kind of sneak in the ending there, doesn't he?
It is like Rod Serling 400 years early.
Yeah, so yeah, it's all this underwhelming stuff, and yet it ends on a high note. That is a favorite because of that twist there?
I like it because of the twist. I like it because of that sense of honesty. I like it because it's funny, and I like it because it's one of the first sonnets that I was ever exposed to, and so it's a personal favorite for that reason, too.
Do you think it gives us a taste of Shakespeare's personality?
I think it does. He's a wickedly, wickedly funny writer. We can only assume that he was a talented comic actor because he played roles in many of his plays, both comedies and tragedies, not just comedies and tragedies, histories, what we call problem plays. So he must have had just an absolutely delightful sense of humor. And yet from things that we see in the plays, things we see in the sonnets, he was also very, very self-effacing. And I think this sonnet includes some of both of those characteristics.
And I guess saying his mistress's breath reeks must not have meant the same thing in his day.
It didn't mean exactly the same thing, but it wasn't dissimilar.
Really? Okay, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, he's supposed to have coined hundreds and hundreds of words, right, that we still use today.
Yeah, hundreds of words, hundreds of phrases. I think it's absolutely delightful that he coined the phrase household word.
And now he is one himself. Are there any Shakespeare plays that you think really resonate with us that capture the 21st century audience?
I think actually most of them do, and I know that sounds like a cop-out, but we're working on Winter's Tale for Shakespeare in the Park here in Milwaukee this summer, and Winter's Tale is not frequently performed, but as we go through the text and try to discern the meanings and the relationships and the beauty of the poetry, we find that Winter's Tale is completely applicable to personal, political, and power and gender situations that we face today. And that's a fairly – it's not an obscure play, but it's not that frequently performed. So I think most of them do. I think that Shakespeare's themes are – I hate to put it this way because it's such a cliche, but they really are universal. The things that he writes about, the characters that he create, transcend his time and are completely applicable to our time and probably just about every time in between his and ours.
And Ron, in our last moments right now, tomorrow we're going to be asking our listeners to share some of their favorite villains of all time. Shakespeare's plays are rife with villains. Do you have a favorite Shakespearean bad guy?
Oh, boy, that's really tough to narrow down. And one of the reasons it's tough to narrow down is because there aren't as many strict bad guys as you might think.
Iago?
Iago is one of them. Iago is a delightful bad guy, and he is richly and delightfully free of any redeeming qualities.
There we go. That's what we're looking for in a bad guy.
Absolutely. Iago. And Richard III is a fabulous bad guy, and especially delightful because Shakespeare's presentation of Richard III is not politically accurate.
And we're gonna have to leave it there, Ron. I'm sorry, but we're out of time. Thank you for celebrating with us.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
That was Ron Scott Fry helping us celebrate Shakespeare's birthday. He's artistic director for Optimist Theater in Milwaukee.